Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, The Wizard of Oz, My So-Called Life, and Spice Girls. My guest this week is playwright Tyler Dwiggins, who grew up in an isolated rural Indiana farm town where there wasn't much in the way of the arts, especially if someone else needed to use the school's combination auditorium cafeteria. That's why, today, he produces the kind of stuff he was looking for back then, starting with a series of queer-inclusive plays for high schools. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder to check out my YouTube channel, where I post videos of queer pop culture, and head over to my Patreon to watch hours of bonus videos featuring stories of TV and film history. Check out my cute little newsletter, where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on next at mattbaume.com. And big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris at patreon.com/mattbaume, and to everyone who's left a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's my conversation with Tyler. Well, this week I'm talking to Tyler Dwiggins, a playwright, screenwriter, and producer, newly arrived in L.A. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Matt. It's nice to meet you.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Okay, so it's a little inside baseball, but the answer is it was this TV special that used to air in the 90s, and it was called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, 50 Years of Magic. I don't know if you've seen it. It was hosted by Angela Lansbury, kind of circa Murder, She Wrote, Glory Days. She's like wearing a red sweater, speaking to you softly about The Wizard of Oz. And to give a little background information, as a kid, I'm from rural Indiana. So, you know, out in the country, I've seen The Wizard of Oz about a trillion times, as most like rural gay men have. And so I watched the movie basically every day growing up. And somewhere along the way, my mom taped this TV special, the Angela Lansbury special, and they talked about the entire making of The Wizard of Oz and kind of took you not just to the glory days of how successful it was, but took you through the process of L. Frank Baum wrote this book, MGM optioned it and made it, and then these directors were hired and fired and replaced, and then these actors came in, and it was kind of the thing that made me understand that storytelling was a job and that creative decisions were made that led you there, and that's how I got into storytelling and theater and found not just my artistic community, but queer community in the long run. But a lot of it kind of traces back to that initial TV special that taught me that entertainment was a career path.
Yeah, it's so interesting that it's not The Wizard of Oz itself, but it's the story, like the behind the scenes story of all the people, like you're saying, the jobs.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm being honest, The Wizard of Oz itself was huge for me too, and like in many ways more so, but I was like, you know what, he's heard gay men talk about The Wizard of Oz before, he knows the drill.
Were there particular like jobs or like an aspect of the making of the movie that were interesting to you?
Well, I think as a kid, what caught me the most were like the craziest stories that were involved, where they talked about you know, the original actor that was hired to play the Tin Man, who basically had this allergic reaction to the makeup, and they hired a new actor. They replaced the makeup quietly. They also had a moment where Margaret Hamilton, who was the witch, she got like lit up with fire when she exits in the smoke. And what it kind of taught me was that, you know, there's an actor who's playing a part. There's directors who are making choices that we don't see. There's a writer who came up with this story. There's the special effects artists who are responsible for these things. So it wasn't even like that there was one particular job. I can't say that it was knowing that it had a writer that blew my mind. I think what opened the door was the idea that there were all these jobs that weren't what you were seeing. You know, you would see Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Lion, but that there were these actors who played the parts. There were people who were unseen completely that were just as important. And I used to just, my poor mom, who is not in entertainment or the arts, she's just a high school teacher. And I used to just pepper her with questions as we, you know, go to the babysitter about like, why did the actors do this? Why did the directors do that? And it was like the Matrix or something. Like I understood that there was a whole thing that I didn't understand before that.
So tell me about like the place you said it was rural Indiana. Is that right?
Yeah.
What kind of like, how rural are we talking? Like, is it like farmland? Like, did it look like the Kansas?
Kind of. Yeah. I grew up in a very, very small town called Middletown, Indiana. And I went to my high school my grade had like 100 some kids, and we were the biggest in the school's history. Most of the classes were less than 100 people. Across the road from me, we lived, you know, out in kind of a farmhouse. We had pet goats, pet turkeys. Across the road, there were cows in a pasture. So it was, mm-hmm. we did not grow any crops, but we definitely had, you know, a lot of farm animals around.
And so probably not a great place to get into showbiz.
No. To say the least, I do not live in Middletown, Indiana anymore.
Were you motivated to start doing storytelling on your own as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I think in a weird way, like so much, I was an only child until I was almost 9. So I spent a lot of time by myself just watching movies over and over, drawing pictures, writing stories. And then the first show I was ever in was in a community theater in a town nearby. And I played a munchkin, and it was, you know, The Wizard of Oz. So I was very much motivated to tell stories and get involved in that whole world that I now understood existed.
What kind of stories? Like, I know Wizard of Oz seems to have had a pretty major impact. What else did you like? And like, what did you read? And what kind of stories did you want to tell?
Oh my God. I think everything. I mean, obviously I was young enough that it was sort of like the Disney Renaissance moment. So it was Aladdin and Lion King, but I also would watch movies that like maybe weren't that kid friendly for how little I was. I would watch Batman Returns all the time with Michelle Pfeiffer and Michael Keaton. I would watch Wayne's World over and over. So I was like off book on Bohemian Rhapsody at like preschool age. But it's, you know, it's kind of that classic. Obviously, I'm not an only child now, but that thing of having a lot of time to yourself, being out in the middle of nowhere. And I didn't even really live near other kids. You know, all of our neighbors who were pretty spread out as is were older. So I was kind of, you know, this little isolated boy out in the country, just getting obsessed with movies and music too. I was obsessed with Michael Jackson and the Spice Girls and all of that kind of stuff as a kid, and really tapped into pop culture in that way that I think a lot of gay men and queer people in general tend to find that lens into the world.
Now, you said that you played a munchkin on stage. Was that a character, or were there characters that you felt like you really identified with, like, or just pop culture figures who you're like, that's me, or that's what I love, that's what I want to be?
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously Dorothy is like the number one, right? Like, I think every little gay boy that saw that movie was clicking his heels around the living room. So I would say definitely Dorothy was pretty major for me, and kind of, I think I just really connected to her as sort of this person who's a bit of an outsider and has this feeling of looking for something else, you know, something outside of what she can see in her day-to-day life. And, you know, I obviously couldn't name that as a kid. I didn't know what gay was. I didn't know that I was gay, but I definitely had a sense very early on that I was, you know, kind of different and more feminine, and sometimes was getting made fun of for those things, even at a very young age, for how I talked or how I sang or anything like that. So I think Dorothy was kind of the quintessential outsider that I latched onto at that time.
How much of a, like, looking back, little gay kid were you? Like, how feminine, like, did you have an awareness that you were doing things that, like, was not really necessarily what was expected of boys?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a very, very clear understanding of that. I mean, like I said, was huge into the Spice Girls. So I was, like, literally going to school in first, second grade with, like, Spice Girls art supplies, which made, you know, all of the girls love me and all of the boys really hate me. So I think very early on, I was getting, I guess, kind of noticed for being more effeminate in both positive and negative ways. But it was definitely unintentionally my calling card growing up, and the thing that, you know, in this smaller religious town, people kind of zoomed in on and paid attention to. And I definitely got a sense very early on that it was something that not everyone felt good about.
Did you have words for that, or was it just something's weird, but, you know, I don't know if you had like the understanding of like, what is gay?
No, I think for me, I can remember that kind of hitting, but it was once I was a bit older, like probably I'm going to say like fourth grade maybe is when I started getting called gay. But prior to that, it was, you know, Tyler hangs out with the girls. Tyler talks like a girl, that kind of, you know, shtick. And then once I hit like fourth grade, probably, I think I understood both what gay meant in at least a general sense, and also that it was something that was being aimed at me, even though I did not really know that was what I identified as, because I was just, I know some people know they were gay from like the jump. I think I knew I was in some ways queer from the jump, but didn't really necessarily know that I was like liked boys from the jump.
Sure, sure. Now imagine that just got more acute as you got into like your teen years.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's when, you know, obviously, like I said, The Wizard of Oz was sort of that thing that chose me in a way. But I think, you know, as I hit high school, I started really seeking out people who made me feel safe in pop culture. So whether that was my so-called life reruns that were on late at night, or finding, you know, bootlegs of musicals like Rent or Spring Awakening, those things kind of gave me this idea of not only was there a place where I would be more appreciated for being different, but that there were a lot of other people like that out in the bigger world that I didn't necessarily see in my day-to-day life at a small high school.
Yeah. So tell me about like what kept you busy in high school. Were you like a theater kid or an art kid, or how did that work out?
It's actually like, it's so ridiculous. I was a theater kid, but I went to school without a theater program. We didn't really have much in the way of like arts. I took art classes because I was really interested in painting and drawing as well. But so I didn't have theater classes. We finally did a show my senior year because the history teacher, who was also, she was a cheerleading coach at the school, she really loved Grease. And she knew I had done community theater growing up in another town. And so she said, would you want to help me with this? So I basically was directing Grease in my high school cafetorium. Yes, that is a combination of cafeteria and auditorium. And it's just as tragic as it sounds. But I was directing Grease my senior year with, you know, the kids who wanted to get involved in that. But no, there were no drama classes. There was no formal drama club even. So that was the only show we did in my 4 years there.
How did it go?
I think okay. I mean, you know, I'm sure at the time we were like, wow, this is triumphant. It's like Olivia Newton-John who, John Travolta what. But it was, I think, pretty well received as much as it could be. I guess the standards also were like, not high. If there's never been a show before, people are going to be like, that was pretty good compared to, you know, an empty cafetorium.
Sure. Yeah. And did that feel like, I don't know, was it triumphant for you that like I finally got my chance to make a show of my own?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think because it was the first time I really, other than trying to like find people who were in theater and the arts through the internet and message boards and that kind of thing, it was the first time I really got to have a theatrical process that was hands-on, where I was in the room with people and kind of seeing this mission through along with them. And that, I think, was the bigger triumph than like whether or not the show was good, was that we just got to see this thing through from start to finish. And I think in a weird way, that process of having no real infrastructure and no budget was the best. In some ways, it was a better training than even going to college for theater, because there was more to hold you up as you were putting a show on. In this case, we were like making everything ourselves, finding everything ourselves, really doing it in kind of a bootstraps way. And I think that actually is the best way to learn how to make theater and how to make art at all, is to just like find other people who are willing to commit the time and put in the effort. And that's kind of where I think the triumph was.
You know, often those small town, small school drama organizations, if it's not even a drama club, are sort of serve as de facto GSAs. And
yeah.
I wonder if there were other, like looking back, other queer kids who were attracted to that production.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think in particular, there was one kid who was in it was my really, really close friend who was also gay and also came from, you know, religious background. And he actually was more, he was kind of one of those people who did, as I call it, the gay hokey pokey, where he came in and out of the closet and then back in and then out and then back in. Because he grew up in a very religious household, as did I. But that was one of my, I guess that was really my first gay friend and someone that I still, you know, love and talk to and try to keep in touch with as much as you can when you live far mm-hmm. apart. But yeah, that was my first gay friend and a really important one for me.
Was that something that you talked about?
Yeah. I mean, I think more so in the sense that like, I was so deep in the closet that I think at that time I hadn't even really come out to myself, but he was definitely someone that was my first big, not first crush, but the first crush where I felt like, oh, maybe this could go somewhere, which of course it never did because we were both, you know, chickens in Indiana and afraid to do anything. And he wasn't interested in me either. But yeah, he was my first big crush. And so it's, you know, that was my like classic high school unrequited love.
Yeah, that's very familiar to me where you know, there's kind of a limited pool. And yes. So, but you also, you know, despite that, you still have teenage hormones. So you feel like, oh, I got to do something. I'm going stir crazy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a lot of why I think I found my way to Rent and Spring Awakening as kind of cultural touch points, because not only did they have queer characters, but they had kind of a sexuality, obviously, to them and a more raw energy that not only was like, I was obviously intrigued by the sexual themes of that as a kid, but I also, this sort of rebellion that was at the core of both of those shows and of Hair, the musical as well. I think I was really drawn to that kind of stirring in those stories, which again, I think comes back to that thing of just being a kid in a small town and wanting to get out and explore who you are and find other people like you.
Yeah. So how did that wind up happening? How did you get out and explore?
I would say very, very gradually. I think I was definitely a late bloomer. And I started at one college, transferred to another. But once I had settled in the college that I went to, I really started making queer friends that were further along in their coming out journey. I met my first boyfriend at the time. I got really, I guess, just ingrained in the lives of not just other theater kids, but also other queer kids. And that was the first time that I had a world that I was a part of, as opposed to a world that I existed in, I think. Hmm. And that was huge for me, as you can imagine.
Did you have like models for what queer was like in TV or film or music or whatever? Like, did you start to think like, okay, that's the kind of gay I want to be?
In high school, the thing that kind of, I remember moving me really viscerally at the time when I was kind of not coming out to the world, but coming out to myself was, you know, Ricky in My So-Called Life, which had been on TV quite a bit before I was in high school, but it was in syndication by that point. And I remember just being up late at night and watching, are you familiar with My So-Called Life?
Yeah, I watched it when I was the age of the characters.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. So it's one of those shows that comes along at the right time for a lot of people.
I think so too. That's the perfect way of putting it. And it, I remember watching the Christmas episode where Ricky's mm-hmm. kicked out of his house and, you know, the Angela's mom, Patty, kind of comes to find him at this church and to, you know, kind of save the day. And I remember just, I was not a crier growing up, I think because of, you know, the repressed emotions that we all deal with. And I remember just like ugly crying at that late at night by myself watching it at like 15. And there was something about him that like, you know, he was so easy to latch on to because he was, you know, he didn't have a boyfriend. I didn't have a boyfriend. He was, you know, hanging out with the girls, getting all the gossip from them and getting mm-hmm. a lot of bullying and ire from the people around him because of that. And I think he was definitely a really safe haven for me at that age. And then I think the turning point characters is I was coming out into the world and was starting to date and sort of come flying out of the closet was Queer as Folk, mm-hmm. which is obviously another touch point for a lot of people. But the US version of Queer as Folk, I remember seeing that in someone's dorm room, the first episode. Again, weirdly, you know, delayed. It was years after it had aired, but that blew me away at the time. And I think seeing multiple gay characters in the same story who you could say, oh, I'm kind of like this character, but I'm not like him. I'm like this one, not this one. And you got to get a feel for not just them as individuals, but them as their relationships to each other. And that was huge for me to see not just queer love stories and queer sexuality, but also queer friendships. That was enormous for me. And actually the character of Justin was really huge for me because when I saw that and I was in college, Justin, you sort of track from him coming out when he's like 17 or 18 years old up until he's about 22, 23. And that, I was like, why am I so attached to him? Because he's, you know, he's not always the most likable character within the show, but he was the one that I connected to. And I realized at a certain point, I was like, he's the only model I have for being this age and being gay. Every gay character I had seen was either a teen who was coming out of the closet or Will and Jack on Will and Grace, who were in their 30s and kind of had already come into their own. And that was huge for me. And that's why I wound up, you know, writing a lot for characters that are either in their late teens as gay men or in their early to mid 20s, because it's kind of a gulf between coming out of the closet and coming into your own where there's not much you can look to in pop culture.
Yeah, it is a real challenge, both in media and also just socializing, because so many gay spaces are bars, which is tough if you're under 21.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we had, you know, a very, you know, traditional, I mean, I didn't go to college in a super huge town either. So the one gay bar was this little tiny hole in the wall where, you know, you would see the same people every single time you went. But I didn't even go there until I was, you know, obviously old enough to get in. So it is, that's why I think, like you said, theater is such a common space for all of us to find each other and to find the people who are on our side that maybe aren't like us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially like, I think for one aspect, one reason why there's so many queer people in the arts is because if you're going to have to wear that mask anyway, you're going to get real good at, you know, assuming a role and putting on a show for everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, having some autonomy and control over that and being like, I choose the characters and I'm going to create the characters for myself rather than, you know, let society dictate, you know, the kind of person that I need to be because of pressure. I think that's one of the things that gives it's a source of real comfort.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, we're already so tapped in with our duality and with our multitudes that we all contain that it's like, you know, I think a lot of queer people are very good at knowing how to channel that and use it as an artistic tool because we've had to use it as a survival tool for so long. Mm.
So tell me about college. Where was that?
I went to Ball State in Indiana and I was a theater education major.
Okay. What kind of shows did you do and what did you, you know, what were you in? What'd you put on?
I kind of basically used college as a chance to do everything in theater you could possibly do. So anything anyone asked me, I was like, yes, I will do that. I'll figure it out. So whether it was, you know, running lights or stage managing a kid's show or acting or anything, I wanted to do everything. The things that I really found along the way was that I loved the idea of art as a means for social change and not just raising awareness, but if possible, raising money for a cause. So I directed both Stop Kiss and Speech and Debate in college. And those plays, we raised the money ourselves. And then the profits we sent to the Trevor Project as a donation and also a way of raising awareness of the Trevor Project. Because at that point, you know, we were still kind of in that national conversation that was about kind of the rash of gay suicides that had been happening in the early 2010s. And so I just thought the Trevor Project was such a powerful thing that existed in the world. And we wanted to kind of signal boost them within our little world as much as possible. But so, yeah, it was telling queer stories and doing it for a queer cause that was, I think, in college, the most empowered I felt. And then I also found playwriting along the way and started writing my own stuff that kind of dovetailed with that mentality as well.
Did you find that your productions, especially that, like, you know, when it's for a good cause, a good queer cause, what kind of impact did you see those having? Like, so often media gives people sort of the practice or the role models or whatever, you know, it's a way of communicating with other people, the kind of world you want to see, or thoughts about who people are. What impact did you see your show having, especially as a theater education major, where the kind of the whole point, I assume, is to make a difference in people's lives?
Yeah. I mean, I think with those shows were so, I think, powerful for those involved because they existed a little outside the theater program. We weren't necessarily doing them straight through. We weren't like a department show. We were doing this because we wanted to do it. And so a lot of people who came to it, I think, were actors and artists who were either grappling with their own queer sexuality or questioning or had just come out. And it gave, I think, a fair amount of people a safe space to sort of exist in that playground in a fictional sense, whether they were on stage or behind the scenes. And that has kind of weirdly been a through line through my life and career, is getting to, for lack of a better word, like shepherd projects that then lead to people coming out of the closet. I also, when I was a theater education major, the teacher I was working with, Kim Roos, who's the best, my angel, she told me that it was very hard to find high school plays that didn't talk down to high schoolers. Either it was stuff that was so young that they could get away with it, but it was really juvenile, or it was these plays that were way too mature that they would, you know, get chased out of town for producing. And she said, you know, I really want to find more plays that we could do that. At that time, I had written a single play, just to put this in perspective. And I said, with like the ego that only a 22-year-old could have, I was like, I could write something like that. And to her credit, she commissioned it and had me write this play, Subtext, which was this play of vignettes that was about dating in the digital age. And it's a really silly romantic comedy, but there's a gay boy that's at the center of it that's waiting for a text from a boy he likes and trying to figure out if this kid is gay without actually asking him. There's also a lesbian couple that is kind of a coming out scene. But it was a play that a high school could do where the gay characters got to fall in love and nobody died. Because at that point, the only plays I knew of that high schools did were really brave schools would do Rent, where somebody dies, or they would do Laramie Project, which, again, quite obviously is about a horrible tragedy. Then those pieces are so important. I don't mean to be flip about them, but I was like, what are we telling these kids if the only shows they ever get to interact with are shows where they are the dying character, the dead character?
Well, that was certainly like an issue with new queer cinema in the 90s. Like, all this great storytelling was going on, but so often it was really heartrending. I remember like being in college and all the recommendations were like, Boys Don't Cry, and like the most uplifting one you might find is Jeffrey, which is all about people like HIV anxiety. Are all of our stories bummers?
Yeah. And I think like it is that weird thing where it's like it does come from a position of privilege of being, you know, a millennial and being able to like say, you know what, it's time for a story about queer joy and routinely telling stories about queer joy. Because I know, you know, at the time of New Queer Cinema, those were stories that people had been waiting to tell and dying to tell because they were exactly what was happening. And they were a lot of people's experiences. And I think as the world has moved on, as the world has become more accepting, there are a lot more realities for queer people, both positive and negative. And I think the sad truth is, I think especially in film, we still live in a world where a lot of the queer stories that end, they're just like, they're very depressing by the end, you know? And I think those are important stories. I'm not saying those shouldn't be told, but we need the flip side as well. And I think especially for young queer kids in the theater education world, it was really empowering to them to get to either play a gay character on stage or be in a show where they were playing a straight character, but there were gay characters on stage that got to fall in love, that got to be just as silly and pining and stuck at unrequited love as their straight counterparts were. And that wound up really being huge for me, both in terms of like a career artistic sense, but also just as a person. It was so powerful to see these kids who, at that point, you know, I was in college, so I'd been in high school not that long before, and I could have never imagined doing a show like that in my school. You know, that would have been not just impossible, that would have probably been kind of dangerous, I think. And so it just blew me away to get to be part of something like that. And it's still one of my favorite experiences was putting subtext up.
What do you think it was that gave you the nerve to be like, hey, I'm just some guy, I've written one play, I've done a little bit of theater in college. I'm gonna write the play that this woman said that she wanted to see in the world that nobody else has done. How did you have the balls to be like, yeah, okay, I can do that.
You know, honestly, I think it comes less from, that sounds so showbiz. It's like less courage and more desperation. I think so much of my life as an artist and as a person has been not seeing the opportunities and just either making them myself or flinging myself at the ones that I see nearby.
What was the desperation? Like, what were you desperate for?
Just to communicate some sense of how I saw the world and who I was to the world and to fill this void that I saw where there were so few characters that I related to or that resonated with. And also I think even before that, I had been trying to be a professional writer from like basically like age 19. And really even before that, I was writing, before I wrote plays and then screenplays, I wrote YA novels that I was like pitching to agents and query emails as like a 19-year-old. And I remember submitting a novel to a novel writing contest that David Levithan's company ran when I was like 15, 16 years old. And so I have just always been, I think, desperate for those opportunities to get my work out there, because I think it comes from those years of kind of like sitting on my hands and being in a place where there were no opportunities. I've just tried to either make them or chase them as hard as I could. And when Kim said, you know, I have a hard time finding these plays, it wasn't even necessarily that I thought I was going to write a gay play for her. I was just like, I can write a comedy for you that these kids will like, because I knew the kids. I knew what they thought was funny. And then actually, to her credit, she and I talked about it, and we're like, you know, we knew we had a lot of queer kids in that program, but I didn't know if we could get away with that on stage with having queer characters. And to her credit, she said, we should absolutely do that because those are the kids we, you know, take care of in this program. And they should be able to see that on stage and be that on stage. And so she was really the person who said, like, let's go for it. Let's do it.
What did you want the audience to come away with?
The big idea of the play was that, you know, we live in this time where digital communication is so simple and so quick, and we can text and we have social media and we can always know what's happening, but we're very bad at communicating our emotional truths. And the kind of core line of the play is that love is a lot of things, but it's rarely a thing of convenience, that it's, you know, it's worth putting yourself on the line for in a more real way than a selfie or a text ever could. Even though it's a comedy and it's a very silly play, I don't want to make it sound like it's this really ponderous thing. But that was really the idea of the play. And then because of, you know, my worldview as well as Kim's, we wanted there to be a tapestry of different kids in the show. So a lot of the couples in the play are straight couples that are dealing with dating in the age of technology, but it's also gay characters, and they're never really handled with any different level of stakes. The stakes are really high throughout the play because it's about teenagers dating, so it's always, you know, at a 10, and it's a comedy.
I just watched both versions of West Side Story, and it's true that like those kids, like I look at the more distance, the older I get, the more distance I get from my teenage years, the more I look at those, like, and Romeo and Juliet, and I'm like, you dumb teens. But also, like, I've been there. I know how it feels. Like, you know, the first time or the first few times that you fall in love, it's this new discovery of this like welling up of emotion that's more powerful than anything you've ever felt. And it of course it feels like it's the most important thing in the world.
Yeah. And it's like, what's more ripe for comedy than that, you know? And it's so many people have told that story. So why not include gay people in it. But yeah, I mean, I think it sounds very healthy that you can look at that and feel very distant to it. I feel like the minute I think about that headspace, I'm right back there. Like it's that is a time in life that I think kind of seared itself on me. And it's so easy for me to like find myself back in that headspace of like what that time in your life feels like.
When you wrote that play, what did you know about being in love?
Being in love? What did I know about being in love? Woof. At that point, I had had not just my first relationship, but my first real kind of heartbreak. I dated this one guy who wound up essentially going to like ex-gay therapy, who I don't really know anymore. But that was, as somebody who'd grown up in a religious background, to not only, you know, go through this breakup and lose this big first love, but to sort of have it be with the underlying message that everything that had happened between us was sinful and an abomination, all those silly things people think, it sort of, I think, at that point confirmed this idea that not only was I someone who could be left behind easily, which was my fear, but it also confirmed that, like, he viewed this relationship as something that was so detrimental to not just his life, but his like soul. And that was like a really heady thing to struggle with at like age, you know, 19 and 20 years old. And so then I think I just threw myself through the ringer of various types of boys. And I sort of tried on dating every type of boy you can find in a college. I was just, and that was like the beginning of social media. So a lot of the silliness of that play comes from the silliness of how I was viewing the world of, you know, sending a text to the wrong person where I was talking about them or trying to decode someone's. I was able to cover it better than they do in the play, but absolutely happened.
My God. How did that happen? And how did you cover that?
It was really easy. I was talking about, two friends, one of whom I thought, you know, liked the other. And I was like very over this ongoing, will they, won't they? And I was kind of like, will they just get it over with? But I didn't use their names in the text. So I was able to sort of be like, oh, I was texting the next person I knew in alphabetical order about someone else that they knew. So it was very, I frantically came up with something, but luckily I hadn't used the name like the character does in the play. But that was definitely an inspiration point, kind of poring over someone's social media and trying to figure out not just like, are they gay or not? Do we have a future? Like, would they like me? Who is this person? You know, which of course, like social media tells you about, you know, 4% of who a person actually is. And maybe not even that some of the time.
Yeah, so it's like negative percentages sometimes.
Yeah. So I think so much of the foibles of that were around me, you know, finding and losing love for the first time and then trying to find love and flirtation and all of those things in college and the various mess ups of me and my friends that I was watching along the way.
What was the reception to the show?
You know, it was funny. The first night that we opened, and the school was really cool because they had both a traditional proscenium stage, which is what most people think of as theater, is like a big, you know, stage with a frame on it. But they also had a black box stage where we were all kind of in the round. So you could see the audience members across the way. You could hear them. Like you really could feel the audience around you, which for a show like this in Indiana felt very scary. I was like, oh God, what are we going to do? And when the play starts out, the gay kid that's kind of the central character that ties through all of it, he's kind of like Bobby and Company, where he's not in every scene, but he's like the through line that you follow between all the vignettes. Sure. And at first you don't know he's gay. And then you, within probably like 2 minutes, you figure out that he, you know, likes this boy. He's trying to figure out if he might like him back. And you could feel any play that I've ever been involved with or seen, it takes the audience a second to know where to laugh and to feel comfortable. And they were, you know, getting into that zone. And then they find out the character's gay, and it got very quiet. And I don't know how much of this is my imagination and how much of it was real, but it definitely felt like there was this moment of everybody in the audience's gears turning. And it was, you know, an audience of a lot of parents, as high school theater shows tend to be. And I was like, oh God, what are we going to do? We're going to get like chased out of here by like a mob, a tiny mob, but a mob. But then the kind of miraculous thing that happened with that production is the next scene and the scene after that are about straight couples and they're, you know, being just as silly, but the audience understood how to laugh with those characters. And by the time you got back to the lead character, Cameron, the gay boy, they were sort of primed to laugh. And you could feel like a difference in how much they would laugh at that second scene with Cameron versus the first, because they were, they're, you know, as laughter does, their defenses were down and they were able to laugh with this character the same way they had the straight ones. And it was this really powerful thing. And I remember hearing, you know, from some of the kids that their parents said to them, you know, you told me what this play was about and I didn't know if it was a good idea. And I saw it and at first wasn't sure if it was a good idea, but I really wound up liking it. It really made me laugh. I enjoyed it. And I think it was this interesting thing where it got to reach people who wouldn't see, you know, I'm sure most of the people in that room hadn't seen Boys Don't Cry or Spring Awakening or whatever. They were able to see this rom-com where a few of the characters happened to be queer. And I think it wound up being this really cool thing, not just for the kids, but I think for some of the adults who maybe had their eyes and minds opened a little bit by it.
Oh, that's great. That's the thing you want to do. Like, it's great to put on the show for the people who are in it, but also like when you can actually impact an audience, it's even better.
Yeah. Well, and it's been interesting too, because that's of all the projects I've gotten to put out into the world, that one has had the longest life because it was my first published play. So It's been interesting to, I used to do a lot of like Zoom talkbacks and FaceTime talkbacks with the schools that were doing my shows. And I would hear from schools where there was this one school in Ohio where their principal tried to shut the show down. He wanted them to change the characters to make them straight or pick a different play, which I don't let people change the characters to be straight. Cause I'm like, you can just do The Crucible or something. You don't need to change my play. But they wound up like sort of, the kids wound up doing a letter writing campaign to this principal, and they got other teachers to write letters about why they thought, you know, LGBT representation was important. And the principal wound up reading all these kids' letters and deciding to put subtext forward and to still let the play run as written, which, again, all that to say, that's not really subtext that did that. That's that those kids. And I feel so honored that my play got to be the vehicle they used to sort of create change in their town and to tell a queer story. Cause I'm aware that they could have done that with any number of queer stories, but it was one of those moments hearing them tell me about that where I was like, oh, this, I got to be part of something cool and I wasn't even there, you know?
Wow. That is like good for those kids. And also principle, I guess, like coming around.
I know. I mean, it does show you, like, I think coming from where I'm from, you know, I joke about the Midwest and about rural Indiana and all of that, but I have seen a lot of people's minds and hearts change over the last decade through all kinds of reasons, political reasons, pop culture reasons, reasons within their personal life of realizing they know queer people they didn't realize they knew, all of that stuff. I mean, we just live in a, for better, I think it's definitely for better. I don't know why I was going to say for better or worse. We do live in a world where I think a lot of people are in a different headspace from what they were 10, 15 years ago.
So tell me what came next. I know there's been a long career after that of more plays and putting stuff on the web and making stuff.
Yeah, making stuff, which, yeah, I kind of started making, you know, storytelling more of a career after Subtext. And I wrote more plays for the school market. Not all of which had queer characters, but usually had some sort of like social message baked into them, which I was really proud of. And then one of the next things I did as I was kind of finding my way was I wanted to write a coming out play that dealt with, you know, religious angst and living in the Midwest. And I was like, dear God, like, how do I do that? Because everyone has done that. Like, you always hear, I hate people that say this, but the idea of like, do we really need more coming out stories? Which I always think is so stupid. It's like, if we can support a trillion Marvel movies a year, I think we can have like three coming out stories. But I decided to write this play that kind of took, I called it my gay Pixar play, and that it took fantastical elements and added them into a coming out story. So it, in the scheme of like Inside Out or Monsters, Inc., where you have these magical worlds that interact with ours. It's about this religious kid who's an imaginary friend from his childhood. She comes back on his 16th birthday to kind of force him out of the closet. And it's comedic and dramatic, and it's has flights of fancy and literal characters flying around the stage. It's my favorite thing I've written because it really had everything I wanted. It's romantic. It tells you a story that is, I think, really full and dimensional of what that teenage time is in your life. And so that just got published recently, and I'm really hopeful that particularly colleges will find that play. It's not for the high school market, and it's the first thing I've put out that isn't for high school and middle school. So I'm nervous but excited for that. But yeah, The Binding is my little gay Pixar play.
That sounds really fun. It actually reminds me, I may not be the first person to bring this up. Do you know the movie Drop Dead Fred?
Someone actually brought that up to me literally just last year after the play was already, or it was this year. God, this is the longest year of my life. Somebody brought that up. I have never seen that movie, but I it's on the list. I know I need to.
Mm. Yeah, it's, I think, a very different take, but kind of a similar idea of like imaginary friends returning to remind us of who we were, who we are, who, you know, the things that are unresolved from the past. And, you know, I am really interested in the idea of that being an opportunity to investigate the change that one might avoid for a long time and sort of becomes unavoidable by the time you're in your teens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, what I loved about this sort of like metaphor of the imaginary friends for pushing you out of the closet was that butting up with the religious themes of it. Not that I'm saying religion is imaginary, but the idea that you sort of have to like go on leaps of faith in your life, whatever kind of life you have and whatever is your point of view, that you have to find things to believe in and find ways to believe in yourself and the people around you. And so the idea of religion and imaginary friends both coming with like, they were both worlds with their own rules. They were both worlds that required you to take a leap of faith. And I thought that was something that kind of went beyond coming out of the closet and is even more universal than that, that it's something that I think everyone deals with in their own way. And I hung it on, you know, a gay coming out story.
Was there something that did that for you? Gave you something to believe in?
I think so. I mean, I think in a way, all of the things we've talked about have given me something to believe in. I think finding the arts and finding other queer people, I think it all gave me so much to believe in. And watching, I think, the people in the world around me go through their own versions of the same trials and tribulations gave me something to believe in. That there's... This sounds so hokey, but I think I found a way to view everyone in the world as somebody who's trying, that they're trying to make the world better. They're trying to help people. Of course, maybe not everyone is, but I think most people are trying to fix the world, even if they have really fucked up ways of doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing I came to believe in was maybe not the goodness in people, but the goodness in people's attempts. And I think that's what I found to love and believe in about the world.
So your current thing is the Queen's English. Tell me about that and how that came about.
Yeah. Queen's English is actually, it's the project that came directly from what I was talking about with Justin and Queer as Folk, of not seeing, because obviously in that show, even most of the characters are in their 30s. And then there's Justin, who's the younger character, and sort of wanting to see characters deal with that chunk of time in their lives, especially right after college, where you're, for most people, like they've come out of the closet, they've found their way out into the world as a queer person, but they're still, you know, fumbling through love, fumbling through early jobs, not quite sure who they are, and the friendships they find and lean on along the way. And it was obviously also a bit inspired by Girls or Sex and the City or Insecure, this idea of like sort of friendship and rom-com like mushed together. And Queen's English is basically a story about these queer friends who are in their early to mid 20s. And the main character is Gabe. He's kind of this wayward twink who is in the middle of a breakup from a Catholic boy. Read into that as you will. There's the drag queen best friend who's kind of stuck in the friend zone. There's his friend Olivia, who is wants to be an actress but sort of falls between types because she's biracial, she's bisexual. No one quite knows where to put her or where to place her as an actor, and it makes her feel out of place. And so it just was this story about queer friendship, which I think even in the queer media we have is very rare. Most stories, the other queer characters, they're in love with each other. It's not necessarily stories about the complications of our friendships, about our competitiveness, the sexuality, the jealousy, but also the love and real community we build with each other. And the reason it's called Queen's English is because each episode starts with a Merriam-Webster-style definition of a gay slang term. So twink, kiki, pause, ex-gay, whatever, you'll get a definition for it. And sometimes that word is the theme of the episode. Sometimes it's literally a passing reference in the episode. So you have to kind of pay attention to where it comes up. It's like a fun little Where's Waldo. but it's the idea in my head was that these characters are figuring out how to define themselves as queer people and as just human beings, and that the definitions are kind of their own versions of definition for the audience.
So where is this happening? Where can people find it?
Yeah, so it's on YouTube. We wanted to make it free and accessible to as many people as possible. So Queen's English web series is on YouTube available. Our second season we just shot during COVID with the help of Screen Actors Guild and their many helpful COVID rules. But we're putting out three final episodes which come out December 2021. So we're in that now. So they'll come out each Wednesday in December.
That must have been a difficult process to shoot a web series right around now.
Yeah, this is probably coming back to that thing of like, I just have to find a way to like tell stories and make stuff where I go crazy. But we had put the first season out, and the last episode came out in like November of 2019, and it ends on this cliffhanger. And we were lucky enough to start to build up a bit of an audience, but we entered a pandemic and all these people are commenting, what happens next? What happens next? I'm like, yeah, what happens next to all of us? Cause we're in COVID now. But yeah, it was very hard. Luckily we didn't start filming until I think it was October, November of 2020. So by that point, SAG had put out, clear parameters of how to use masks on set, how regularly to do the testing, temperature checks. Everything was kind of thought out for us. So we had really clear rules to work within, but it was definitely very hard. I'm proud to say no one got COVID from our set, which I'm really proud of. We worked really hard at that. And the thing about the show was a lot of it was already 2- and 3-person scenes because that's, you know, web series. It's an intimate story. But yeah, so it was, we mostly just had crews that were in masks at all times and kind of went from there. But it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I don't recommend making a web series in a pandemic, but I also don't really recommend a pandemic. So it is what it is, but we made it through and it's finally coming out.
And now you've just moved to Los Angeles. Is that so that you can do more stuff like this?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in TV, but I think growing up, that seemed even more far flung than theater. It didn't even seem like that was something that someone from Indiana could do. And I think as I've gotten older and learned more about the world, I realized I really wanted to pursue TV. So I'm really hoping to find my way into TV and film world and hopefully get to tell a lot of more queer stories along the way. But yeah, that's what brought me to LA. In addition to spending, you know, a lockdown in a tiny New York apartment, I was like, that was also a reason to be like, you know what, let's rip off the Band-Aid. Let's try this out.
What are your plans for like, or I guess your expectations for what Los Angeles is going to be? And you've been there, like, it's been like literally a few days for you, right?
No, a few months. It's a few months. Okay. Yeah. We moved in mid August. So I'm actually already really loving it. I always had a pretty complicated relationship to New York City in that, you know, I found so many of my favorite people in the world there, but I found the pace of it really exhausting, especially for somebody who's used to growing up in, you know, a farm town in Indiana. So LA has been really beautiful for me in that I've been able to still feel like I'm tapped into a queer world. I'm in a big city that has, you know, artistic and personal opportunities and people that I want to build community with. But it also has the outdoors. I can go to the beach suddenly, which is wild, a thing I never imagined in life, and going to the mountains to hike. And it's been a really beautiful thing to come into. I feel really at home here, which probably sounds stupid for a place that I've lived in for 3 months, but I'm kind of falling in love with it. It's a bit of a honeymoon phase.
Well, that's great. And then like in terms of like work projects, do you have like, I don't know, are you looking at what comes after Queen's English?
Yeah, definitely. I just wrote a pilot with my friend Misha Oshirovich, who's a non-binary actor and writer, and they were just in the movie Freaky, which is a really fun horror comedy movie that's a cool genre blend. But they asked me if I wanted to write a script with them, so we're working on something right now that's another kind of version of a flipped on its head coming of age dramedy. But yeah, that's kind of the next thing I'm focusing on right now. But the big thing is just like getting Queen's English out and trying to get the word out about it and help people to find it. Because at the end of the day, that's the kind of thing I want to put into the world is more stories about queer love and queer friendship. So just trying to help that reach as many people as it can so that hopefully later I'll be able to do it with like a real budget.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like, you know, how much it seems like you are making the world or making the project that you were looking for, like when you were a kid, mm-hmm. in Indiana and felt a little disconnected from queer life. Like, is this sort of a creation of the sort of friend circle that you wanted to have and that you wanted, you know, to be available to queer people in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I think absolutely. And I think it's a mixture of both. And I think in a weird way, it's still just as vital for me to sort of put out these stories of friendship and community, especially because, you know, living and working in the arts, it can be a little, you see people all the time when you're working on a project with them, and then you know, either lose touch with them or you only get to see them every so often. So it's, I always feel like I have a very sprawling community in New York and in Chicago and now in LA and in Indiana, but I don't, because of the career I've chosen, I don't necessarily always have a group of people that I'm seeing all the time. And I think it's still one of those things that I kind of love because it's not necessarily always the part of my day, even though I have close friends in, luckily, a lot of parts of the world now. But it's, I think that sort of idea of like a close-knit tribe is just as appealing to me now because it's still harder to come by, I think, as I get older and maybe have less time to just hang out with people and go on adventures.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's certainly something that like having the freedom to create that world, like, you know, fictionally, I think is one of the ways that it sort of jumps off the page or out of the concept and into real life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I just love it. I always joke about it, but I really have such a love for other queer people, and it always sort of breaks my heart to come across people, and we've all met them obviously, but people who seem to really not like other queer people or try to distance themselves from other queer people or in men, especially from their femininity or whatever. And I just love the tapestry of our community, and I've always wanted to find ways to honor who we are and put us out there in a way that is joyful and silly and romantic. Because I think we're really dimensional and we have so many stories to tell beyond the tragedies.
So one more time, tell me where folks can find the show.
Yeah, Queen's English is, you can find it either on YouTube, Queen's English web series with my name, Tyler Dwiggins, or you can go to queensenglishtv.com and the episodes are uploaded there as well. But the YouTube is probably the easiest way to find them.
Fantastic. Tyler, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Matt. This was such a pleasure.
Thanks to Tyler for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod and Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.